Well, greetings once again to all of Turdville. It is Thursday. It is noon Eastern, and that means we have ourselves another A2A presentation this week with a new guest, a guy that I first was able to meet a couple of months ago, and he has graciously come on to join us here for A2A. This is Grant Williams that we have on the line this week. Grant, most of you know, first and foremost, he's a Singapore-based money manager. But he also writes the fantastic newsletter, Things That Make You Go, Hmm. I'm sure most everybody has seen that from time to time. It's often cited on Zero Hedge. It gets kicked around the internet. He's also the co-founder of an excellent service that everyone should consider called Real Vision, where they get down and dirty with excellent interviews of folks that see the world probably without the propaganda spin that we get from the mainstream media and the central bank. So Grant is a great champion of our cause, and it's a treat to have him here. Grant, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
That's very, very kind, and an overly kind introduction. Thank you.
Well, you know, we try to do our best. All right, everybody listening, if you remember how this works, we do this in the GoToWebinar platform. So that you can eventually ask some questions. I've got my own questions first. I've got some emailed questions we got to get to. But if you have a question of Grant, you click the questions tab on the GoToWebinar control panel and type it in. And then I relay it to him. But Grant, before we get started, I've got my own stuff. You know, I've several times in the last month, I have reposted and embedded and tweeted that outstanding presentation that you gave back in December in London, and then you put it on YouTube in January called Nobody Cares. And I think it's about as succinct and as brilliant of anything that we've seen recently. But we're starting to get some people to care. How about that? How do you feel about things now that we're about halfway through 2016?
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, it does seem like a few people are starting to care. But it's, you know, it's still not... We don't have that mass acceptance. We don't have that mass buy-in from the really big movers that can move these markets. And yet, you know, you see what we've had. We've had gold's best quarter in 30 years or something. So when you look at what a few people starting to care has done to the gold price in the last five and a half months, it becomes very, very clear what will happen once we start getting pension funds, for example, moving wholesale into gold. Yeah, this market is very tight. The liquidity is all in paper, and people are going to be wanting the physical, which is a large part of the point of the presentation. And so it's been a long wait for people that have held gold. I don't think we're quite there yet. I don't think we're quite at liftoff yet, but we've certainly put a decent floor. I think we'll see some more fluctuations. But a few people caring has made a world of difference, and if what I expect to happen happens, and we start to see large-scale institutions start to allocate more of their funds to precious metals, I think what we've seen so far this year is just the tip of the iceberg.
My friend, you teed up a follow-up question there. What do you expect to happen when you say what I expect to happen happens? What do you expect to happen?
Well, it's as you watch the passing parade, which we've had to do for the last 8 years, you see a group of men and women around the world, well-intentioned, I'm sure, but fighting forces that are far bigger and more powerful than the tools they have to fight them with, and they're getting increasingly desperate. And at the end of the day, what we have here is a problem of there being way too much debt. And that's what 2008 was a warning shot about. That was, you know, the first symptoms in the patient, if you like. The medicine that was applied was done to do anything possible to sort of stabilize the patient rather than cure it. And since then, we've had tens of trillions of dollars of additional debt piled on to try and keep this whole thing together. Now, what we're starting to see now with, we went to QE, obviously we went to zero interest rates, and now we're moving into negative interest rates. And you can see, if you look at the response to the move to negative interest rates, that the markets are starting to not do what the central banks want them to do. And this is a crucial point to understand. And it's the most obvious sign of this was when the Japanese central bank put negative rates on the table on January the 29th, 2 weeks after, sorry, 8 days after Kuroda-san, the Bank of Japan governor, had said that they were not on the table. He instituted them. It was a surprise, another shock and awe move on the part of the central bank, which they've been very used to in the last number of years having the desired effect and shocking and awing the market into doing what they wanted. This time, the move to negative rates was designed to weaken the yen, which had stopped weakening, which is a core part of Abenomics, and send the Nikkei higher. And the instant reaction to that news was exactly the opposite of what the Bank of Japan had intended. The yen strengthened noticeably, and the Nikkei fell 1,000 points in half an hour. Now, they rallied the market, and the yen sold off a little bit towards the end of the day, so they got them back to roughly unchanged on the day. But over the next 2 weeks, they both went 16% in the wrong direction.
Yep.
And that, to me, was a very important marker for people to pay attention to. That's where the market started maybe to question that the central bankers had complete control of this. And with what's happened since, you look at what's happening in Europe, you look at the damage negative rates are doing to the banking system, and suddenly gold doesn't become such a wasted asset. You can hold gold now, and actually, instead of paying money to a kindly bank to store your cash for you, you can put it in gold and not pay any carry apart from a small storage cost. So gold's starting to look attractive. A lot of very smart, well-respected people are starting to become very vocal about gold. We saw another one today in George Soros, who's allocated a bunch more money to gold. And these are the things that people really need to pay attention to. Look at who is starting to talk about gold positively, because these are the people that not only move markets, but sway opinions amongst allocators around the world. And if that follows through, which I fully expect, to the institutional side, and particularly pension funds, I think, as I said, I think what we've seen so far in 2016 is going to pale into insignificance as the tightness of the market really starts to come to the fore.
And more people care. You know, I guess that's really, to me, the key fundamental too, Grant. I was just writing about this today. I mean, the German 10-year Bund is at 4 basis points. 4! And the 5-year is well negative, something like 25 basis points negative. And I guess my question is, again, that obviously augurs well for gold. Why not hold gold? You know, if the argument is always, well, gold doesn't pay a dividend, well, it beats the pants off of a negative dividend. How does that get unwound? I mean, is there any way that Germany can move? I mean, how do you ever get back to a normal yield curve, a positive sloping, positive yield curve? I mean, is there any way?
It's a great question, but this is something else I find very interesting. We've spoken for the last number of years, and the question is always, how do the central banks get back to a normal interest rate environment? And the answer is they don't. The market takes them there, and that's what will ultimately happen. The market will once again set interest rates, and there's going to be a real struggle and a real tug of war over this once it starts to happen. But my good friend Bill Fleckenstein likes to say, the market is going to take the printing press away from the Fed. And I think that's exactly how this plays out. We forget, and I've spoken about this a number of times, but people always ask me, where are the bond vigilantes keeping these guys honest? And I have to remind people that the bond vigilantes are a group of mythical beings who are on the side of profits. And right now, or for the last several years, the easy profits have been made following the central banks and buying bonds. At some point, they're going to realize that the rubber's going to meet the road and the money's going to be made in getting short government debt. And that's when you're going to start to see these guys really struggle. And we've got the Japanese yield curve negative after 17 years. We've got Switzerland negative to a similar degree. But what I find fascinating is that people struggle to hold in their heads the concept that the U.S. 10-year could go to 50 basis points.
Yeah.
Well, of course it could. I mean, it seems to me, I'd like someone to tell me why it won't go to 50 basis points, frankly, when you have a lot of what, in respect of the global currency order, is inferior debt. The U.S. 10-year is trading over Spain. Spain has $1.1 trillion of negative-yielding sovereign debt. Spain. I mean, this is a country that has had a government for 6 months and in which the Communist Party is now the second biggest party, and yet they have about $1 trillion of negative yielding debt. We live in a fantasy world that has been created by central banks out of necessity, and realistically the only real part of any of this narrative right now is gold, and it sits in the middle, and it sits there very patiently, and at some point people are going to think that the twists and turns in this plot are just too outrageous, and they want to go back to something real, and the only thing that's really going to be there, sitting there waiting for them, is gold.
Yeah. One last question before we start getting some of the listeners and what's been sent in. You mentioned it's a great part of the Nobody Cares presentation where you talk about you know, if you just put in $100, then this is at prices at the end of last year, but if you just put in $100 billion dollars, you could buy all the almost every single gold or gold related investment in the world. Do you own in your fund? Have you benefited from the move in the miners over the last 4 months, and how do you feel about them?
Yeah, look, I mean, the miners have done what the miners do, right? When gold's going up, they go crazy. When gold's going down, they are painful things to own. So I've been on both sides of it. I've held them through the pain. I've made some money through the good times in the last 6 months. But for me, it's very important with something like gold to have – if you understand the reasons for owning it and you believe the reasons for owning it, it makes sense to own a core position. And I don't worry about that, which is why when I say – I don't think we're maybe there yet. I think we're going to see another flush out, maybe a couple, who knows. But my core position, I don't touch that. The price is the last thing that's relevant to me with that. It's just about how many ounces I have.
Yeah.
The rest of it, when you see these moves, look, I mean, the gold stocks are up the best part of 100% from the lows. You know, that's something, anything you own, whether you believe in gold or not, that's something you should think about fading just because. It's just smart thing to do is fade that rally, particularly in something as volatile as gold. So I've been in them. I've had some pain. I've had some good times. I'm long. I've trimmed some positions because, as I say, I expect there to be another flush out at some point. But it all comes down to me, to the holding period, and my holding period is not a week or 6 months. It's 3, 5, 10 years, depending on the broader conditions.
Right, right. All right, I've got two questions that have been emailed in, and then I want to, anybody that's listening that has a question for Grant, again, you just click the questions tab in the GoToWebinar control panel, type it in, and I'll relay it to him. And Grant, I got to tell you, sometimes these jump around. You never know what everybody's going to ask, so if you're ready, I'll start laying them on you.
Yeah, let's go.
First one comes from a site regular, goes by the name of Hindsight 101, which, you know, my hindsight, I don't know about yours, but mine is just perfect. I mean, it is sharp. Anyway, Hindsight wants to know, he'd appreciate your comments on this whole registered eligible thing at the COMEX. I personally see it just as a data point because it's all kind of a sham anyway. It's kind of the illusion of delivery. But nonetheless, Hindsight wants to know what you think, because much is made of the dwindling registered numbers, particularly lately in silver. Do you have any idea who owns eligible metal and how fungible eligible is into registered? Is that anything you follow at all?
Yeah, like, I mean, I follow it. I've seen silver's down to 15-year lows in the COMEX warehouses. And I think this is one of those things that I think people look at, and it's the numbers are kind of crazy, and so a lot of people think they don't matter. It's that law of large numbers at work again. People think they don't matter, and they don't, frankly, until they do. And this is a big part of this precious metals complex, because, and this was really the central message of Nobody Cares, was that the guys like us that spend our lives focusing on this market, we look at it up close, and it seems so obvious to us, and the numbers, all kinds of numbers, whether it be the number of outstanding claims per ounce, or whether it be the dwindling stocks, or the complications of the ETF and the reality of what that actually gives you ownership of. We look at this stuff and we pay attention to it, and it all screams at us every day. But outside, and I use this in the non-pejorative sense, outside the gold bug community, nobody cares. People just aren't looking at this stuff. It really takes people outside to come into this market to want to own physical gold. And then we will see what these numbers mean. At that point, when we get pension funds who are buying gold and standing for delivery, that's the point where we're going to see what these numbers mean. Until we do, yes, they all look suspect. They do look really bad. And they do look as though there's very little gold to actually be delivered. But until people actually want to take delivery of that, we're really not going to know what it means. So I watch them with interest, but I'm far more interested in looking at the flows into the metal. I'm looking at the sort of profile of the people, you know, like Stan Druckenmiller, like George Soros. You know, Stan Druckenmiller bought a ton of GLD. I mean a ton precisely. He bought a lot of GLD. yeah. his single biggest. He very, very overtly called it his single biggest currency position. Now, he's not quite yet made that leap to I want to own physical gold. He wants to be in gold, mm-hmm. and he views it as a currency. It's those shifts. It's when you start to see maybe Druckenmiller talking about taking delivery of the physical, or Soros taking physical instead of buying ETF. Those are the points where suddenly those warehouse numbers become much more meaningful, because you've got real market movers taking delivery of real amounts of the precious metal. And it's crucial to understand the dichotomy between the metal itself and the amount of paper laid on top of it. Ultimately, yeah. the only thing that's going to matter is the physical.
Yeah, we've often talked here. I mean, we're kind of living off of flow. You know, it's like the supermarket that lives off of the just-in-time delivery. That's kind of what the banks are doing. And as soon as there is one hint of failure, one slight loss of confidence that you can get your gold whenever you want it, that's when the fun starts.
Yeah, precisely. And that's when you're going to see. That's when you'll see the people who own the ETF suddenly realize, you know what, I don't actually own gold here. I own a piece of paper. And it'll take something like that to get people to understand that it might seem like a hassle, but you have to own the metal.
Yeah. All right, next question comes from a guy by the name of Lyndon. And this kind of deals with your base of operations out in the what we call the Far East here in the States. He says, Mr. Williams, the U.S. government appears to be arming several Asian countries in the so-called Pivot to Asia strategy in preparation for a possible conflict with China. In siding with the U.S., these countries are opening themselves up to direct conflict with China. What stance is Singapore taking toward China? There is a U.S. port there. Will that make Singapore a target for the Chinese military?
Oh, it's great.
Lastly, let me add on one last thing. He says, does that make it more or less safe to store precious metals in Singapore? So anyway, those two things.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, what's happening in that part of the world as China kind of flexes its muscles has been very interesting to watch. And right now, the posturing is towards the U.S. There's a lot of antipathy between the Japanese and the Chinese. There has been for centuries. The Koreans and the Japanese. There's a lot of long, deep-seated animosity between nations in Asia. The key to all this, and my friend Pippa Malmgren has talked brilliantly about this, a lot of this is to do with securing food supplies. And that's a lot of what the Chinese are doing with the building of the airfields and those crazy rocks in the middle of the Chinese South China Sea. It's about securing food supplies, because China is something that is inherently unstable when you have soaring food inflation, because you've got 1.4 billion people that you need to keep fed.
Yep.
And if you don't, and you're one of those 27 guys, they know where you live. So it's a precarious situation. As far as Singapore is concerned, yes, there's I think the world's second or third busiest port there. We have a U.S. air base there. They do have strong ties with the U.S. military. It's also a choke point for oil, which is perhaps the thing that people most need to understand. I mean, I forget what the percentage is, but a significant amount of the world's oil sails through the Malacca Straits, just past Singapore. So Singapore is certainly a place that will, if there are any flashpoints, it will feature very heavily in those, because strategically it's in a very important location. I certainly don't get any sense that there's any immediate danger to Singapore. I don't think the Chinese are at any point flexing their muscles to that extent. I think we're a long way from that. Right now they're just kind of puffing their chests out, the Americans, as the Russians are doing as well. I mean, it's a similar situation. And again, Pippa, if you haven't seen her, you should look Pippa up on Twitter, Pippa Malmgren. She pays a lot of attention to this, the defense spending, the rising level of conflict between Russia, China, and the U.S., and her work is brilliant on it. So it's definitely something to pay attention to. I don't think it's an immediate threat, but it's certainly not something you can just ignore.
Fair enough. All right, our next question is the first one from a listener, and I've got several in queue, so I probably better get right to it. This comes from Mark, who wants to know how closely you follow the Shanghai Gold Exchange. And he's kind of noticed that, you know, we've made a lot of this yuan-denominated fix that they instilled. First, I guess we'll call it competition for London in 97 years, but yet so far that hasn't had that much of an impact in the first 8 weeks. It doesn't seem to be much arbitrage. It hasn't really affected arbitrage or anything like that yet. What do you make of this? Do you think that's a big deal or not?
I do think it's a big deal. I think it's a much bigger deal than, as you say, that the reaction to it would suggest. And I think that's because this is a place where physical delivery is made. And so it comes into this whole idea of what happens when the physical gold supply gets tight. So I think this is a big deal. I don't think it's really mattered much yet. And again, as I said, all these things, nothing matters to anybody until it matters to everybody. This is just another conduit for physical metal to leave the marketplace and go into safe hands. And this, you know, we have a finite supply of this thing. So the more of it that gradually creeps out in places like this where there is a heavy amount of physical delivery, I think it's 52 times the amount of gold delivered on the COMEX is put through Shanghai already. Mm-hmm. It matters, just maybe not yet. And it's something to pay very close attention to. And the yuan fix, again, is incredibly important. And that hasn't really been understood by people outside who don't really pay attention to this. But having that ability to bypass the US dollar through a medium of payment is something that will spread to oil. I think by the end of the year, there's going to be an oil trading platform in Shanghai, which will also be priced in yuan. These are very strategic moves, and they are very, very important.
Absolutely. Boy, you're not kidding about that. Next question about comes from a guy who goes by the name of Infometron. He said he recently subscribed to Real Vision. So he's a client there, I guess, if you want to call it a subscriber. And he'd like to know. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That sounds wonderful.
Oh, gosh.
Welcome.
He said he'd like to know, out of all the great interviews and position statements, which over the past few months particularly stand out to you as must listens?
Oh, man, this is such a tough question. I'll try and keep my answers brief because I've only got a few minutes left. But there's so many fantastic interviews. I just interviewed Carl Bass last week, which when it airs is just tremendous, tremendous. He's a fantastic guy, but a brilliant thinker. Hugh Hendry was great. There's a young guy on that site called Daniel Want, who's an Australian money manager, a brilliant young man who I think is going to be doing some extraordinary things. There's a great interview with John Hampton. I mean, I'm not trying to plug the thing. There are just so many brilliant minds. And what has been extraordinarily rewarding to find out is that the guys you've never heard of are often some of the most brilliant people you're ever going to hear from. And you just to be able to get access to these guys in a way that you don't get elsewhere has been, I mean, for me, it's I've got the best job in the world. It's fantastic.
Well, and that's the beauty of your platform, you know, is to a lot of these guests wouldn't necessarily see the time of day in Bloomberg or something like that, but they need to be heard.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And they're so gracious with their time and so open with their opinions when they're talking to peers rather than journalists. It's a great environment to get some really, really good information out of people.
Yep. All right, next question from William. He says, regardless of the outcome of the EU referendum in the UK, and given the intractable insolvency of the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and the simple reality that in the final analysis, any bailout of the pigs will predominantly have to come from Germany, what do you consider is the likelihood of Germany dumping Merkel and then abandoning the EU?
Well, Merkel's under pressure already after the immigration fiasco. There, she's for the first time in her tenure, she's under a lot of pressure. But this pressure, the Brexit referendum. Look, as a Brit, I think people underestimate the likelihood of a Brexit. It's a very British thing, but I think there's a bigger chance of it happening. I don't know if it will happen. It's going to go down to the wire, but my belief is that even if it doesn't, it signals the beginning of the end of Europe, because if the Brits don't get through, the Scots didn't get their referendum right. Maybe the Brits don't, but the British one will be a lot closer than the Scottish referendum. And then we move on to the Dutch and the Danes and the French. And if you look at the recent polls of the satisfaction with the European project across Europe, it's plummeting. And so to me, it's only a matter of time before somebody somewhere has a referendum and votes to leave. And I think if the Brits do leave, they'll be the first of several, and I think the whole thing's going to fall apart. But whether it happens now after the EU, the British referendum is held in 2 weeks' time, or it happens further down the track, To me, it's just a matter of time that the EU does not function in its current form. You cannot have monetary union without fiscal union.
Yeah, that might be some of that interest rate market forced reset that you spoke about earlier. All right, I've got two questions left. They both come from Jill, and I would just say to anybody else that has a question for Grant, type it in before we wrap up. This comes from Jill. Jill says she loved the Nobody Cares presentation, but there are some folks that seem to care very much about silver. What does Grant think of silver? Is it just gold needs to make new all-time highs and silver will follow along as if on steroids, like Jim Sinclair says? And what is your take on silver, and what percentage of silver versus gold are you comfortable with?
Well, I mean, that's something that varies a great deal depending on my overall bullishness or bearishness for the asset class. I mean, in those falling markets, silver is a very dangerous thing to own. If you get the turn right and you position yourself correctly in the bull markets, as Jill so perfectly put it, it is gold on steroids, and it's going to trade that way. I mean, the low price just lends itself so perfectly to much more intense speculation. So people tend to throw this thing around with much more abandon. For me, I don't have a ratio I'm comfortable with per se. That ratio changes depending on my fears. If I'm defensive, I'll cut my silver position right back. If I'm in a place where I was at the beginning of this year, where I really think that we're starting to find a bottom, and there are starting to be some people looking at moving into precious metals, then I think it makes a lot more sense to have a heavier allocation to silver. But I would never have more silver in my allocation than I would gold. I think gold is the anchor of that allocation, and I may trade around that position, but I don't own gold to make money. I own gold to preserve money, and so silver is just, I would never buy silver to preserve my capital. I would buy that because I think I can add some alpha to owning a gold position by positioning silver correctly at any given point in the cycle.
Yeah, Jill's follow-up question is, it's such a tiny market. I mean, you could buy the entire globe's one-year production for $16 billion, and you get a handful of pension funds or large investment funds, sovereign wealth funds, that start looking at it could move pretty quickly. I mean, do you factor that in kind of in a same nobody cares type perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jill's hit the nail on the head. This is why it's so important to understand the significance of large pools of capital who cannot get yield anywhere else and are being penalized for holding cash and for holding government bonds. Looking at gold and deciding, you know, we should make an allocation to this, because a tiny adjustment in pension fund allocations will soak up $16 billion of silver. Now, I don't think the pension funds are going to move into silver. You might get some of the more flexible ones maybe do it, but it's going to matter in gold, and if gold is going to get dragged higher by these guys, silver is definitely going to go along with it. But yes, the market is small, and the number of people that really care about it is also smaller, and those two things make all the sense in the world.
Yeah,
and that's why, you know, I keep banging on about this, but it is so important to pay really careful attention to who's talking about being long gold. You know, when you get PIMCO writing the Rumpelstiltskin article, very bullish gold, that's a sign. That's an inflection point, because PIMCO aren't writing about that and then thinking about maybe buying some gold in a month's time. PIMCO are writing that because they're either actively buying gold, they have bought some gold, or it's now suddenly on their radar.
Yeah.
So they're very, very important things to make note of. And yeah, Jill, I think Jill's absolutely right. It's a tiny market that if you get some serious buyers, there's only one direction these things can go.
Grant, you've been very generous with your time. I've got just a couple extra things that came in. I'll ask them quickly, and you can answer them quickly if you'd like.
Absolutely.
Info Metron came back again, just hardly recommends Real Vision to everybody. Just wonders if you even have dollar price targets for gold and silver, given again the idea that these funds and sovereign wealth funds and everybody else are just barely beginning to move into the sector.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I get this question a lot. Excuse me, and I don't. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. I really don't have a price target for gold. You know, in the short term, I might if I'm trading around it. But as I said, I don't own gold at $1,100 because I want to sell it at $1,200.
Right.
I've been buying gold. So the first ounce of gold I bought, I paid $333 for in cash. I've been added to that allocation ever since, and there have been times I've traded around it. So, you know, I think once we get through 1360, I would imagine we take out 1500 fairly quickly. But you're going to get plenty of pauses along the way. This isn't going to be a straight shot to 2,000 or 2,500, as a lot of people seem to think. It's a tough thing to trade. It's a tough position to manage. But I think it's easier to do so if you can separate out that core position that you know you're not going to touch, and then trade gold. Gold trades very well on technical charts. If you're a technician, gold's actually a very good thing to trade because all the emotion are right there in the charts, and they send out some pretty good signals.
Yeah, do you agree with this notion? I'm the same way. People ask me, "What do you think the price?" I say, "I don't know," because I have no idea how much actual gold there is that's free and clear, you know, with clear provenance in the West. Right. If you don't know the denominator, how can you come up with the price?
Yeah, look, it sounds crazy when we're talking about a financial asset, but not having a price target on gold to me is I'm perfectly okay with that because there is no balance sheet. There's no way to value this like a traditional financial asset. So I'm happy to think of it in a non-conventional way. And to me, I like the security of owning it. I like watching the market. You can sense when these things get carried away and when they get a little bit too hot. And it really is aside from that core position, it's a feel asset for me that you tend to try and trade contrarian at both extremes.
Yeah,
it's a tough thing to do, but I think it's the smart way to trade it.
Right. Hey, and just one last question that was sent in, this from Dirt Reynolds. I mean, do you deal with other metals, platinum, things like that, uranium perhaps? You deal with any of that stuff?
Yeah, I follow them. I don't own any of either at the moment. I think uranium long-term is very interesting. I've spoken at length to some guys that know far more about it than me that make a very compelling case for uranium. Platinum, there are times that platinum gold ratio is a great ratio to trade. It's a really good chart. If you look that up, you'll see and there are clear levels where it makes sense to switch out of one into the other. But as I said, I've been core positioning gold and trying not to trade too much around it because I just feel like we're coiled and I just want to have that position at the right point in time. I just don't want to give it up.
Yep. Grant, great stuff. We have a tradition around here as we wrap things up. I call it the final four, just four quickies that you can usually answer in a word or a sentence, but they're always kind of fun. You know? People get to know you a little bit better. If you're ready, can I lay them on you?
Yeah, shoot.
If I understand right, you're a Brit, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, I was just over there a few days ago. In fact, on Sunday night, my family dragged me onto the London Eye, much against my better judgment. You ever ridden that thing?
I have not. No.
Don't do it, man. I couldn't get off that thing fast enough. All right. Now I was touring all over Europe too. What, you tour the globe? What is your favorite city to visit?
Wow, New York.
Ah, okay. I'll live with that. All right. Number three. At the end of the day, it's coming up 2 weeks from today. What will the Brexit vote be? Yes or no?
It's going to be a squeaker. I think it'll be no, but I have maybe a few dollars on a surprise leave vote.
We'll see. You get it like an absentee ballot or anything like that? You get to send
no,
it?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
That's too bad. You're crying out loud. All right, last question. This is one that people always seem to like. You and I are having lunch after this, and I reach across the table and hand you an envelope with 1,300 Federal Reserve notes in it, and you get to go across the street and either buy 1 ounce of gold or 70 ounces of silver. What are you going to do right now, this minute?
Right now, this minute, I'll take the gold.
Fair enough. That's what I always do, too. That's always my answer, but it varies, as you might imagine. All right, Grant, before you go, please tell everybody, one, about how they sign up or how they subscribe or however that works for the newsletter, Things That Make You Go Home. But also, please tell everybody where they go to access Real Vision and how that subscription works.
Sure, that's very kind. Thanks. Things That Make Go Home, the website is ttmygh.com. You can go on there and read all about it and sign up, and if you decide it's not for you, in the first month I'll happily refund anybody's money, which is a very simple return promise to make. And Real Vision, realvisiontv.com, it's a great resource that we've built over the last couple of years, where you'll find interviews with really the most brilliant investors all over the world, talking very openly and very frankly, and sharing their ideas and their wisdom with you in an environment that they just don't get the chance to do anywhere else. So I would encourage you to try that also. So it's a real privilege for me to spend time with these people, and you'll learn a hell of a lot from listening to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Big thumbs up on this end. Grant, thank you so much. It has been a real pleasure to get to know you a little bit and visit with you, and hopefully our paths will cross again sometime soon.
I'd like that very much. Thanks for having me.
All right, and from everybody here at TFMR, thanks for listening. We'll do this again next week.